Ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great pleasure to have Robert Barrow with us today to give the 12th Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures. He's already won a prize for being the first Lionel Robbins Memorial Lecture to arrive with a complete manuscript, and we're very glad that he's taking this as the important occasion, which I think we all feel it to be. As everybody knows, and this is obviously why there's so many of you here, he is one of the world's leading macroeconomists, and he's written on nearly all the big issues in that field. He probably doesn't want to be reminded of his first famous article, which was a bit Keynesian, but he soon became a leading monetarist, and of course he was the first person to seriously investigate empirically the effect of anticipated as opposed to unanticipated money on the real economy. He went on to investigate the determinants of monetary policy, the political economy, if you like, of inflation, and that's another very major contribution that he made. He also wrote what I believe to be the second most quoted article ever written in economics, the one on Ricardian equivalence between tax and debt finance. I think the Coase theorem, Charlie Bean told me, it's Coase's article on social costs. Or if it's not, it's Coase's article on the firm. That's just a sample. But I think that the thing which strikes one about all his work is that he always takes the big issue and tries to find some powerful insight which provides some kind of unifying approach. And in the last few years, he's been working on economic growth. And that's the subject that he's going to talk to us about. The whole series is going to be called The Determinants of Economic Growth. And this first lecture is on growth and convergence. Robert Barrow.
It's a pleasure to be here. I particularly appreciated being put up at the Waldorf Hotel, which which gave us quite a remarkable view of all the military activity occurring on the Aldwych. Well, as Richard mentioned, I'm going to be discussing in these lectures the determinants of economic growth, particularly across countries, and I'm going to be trying to relate that also to the evolution and shape of political institutions. I'm going to try to talk about some fresh empirical results on a field that I've been working on for the last 5 or 6 years now. I feel that this field of this work is not really so much in the Robbins style because it's far too empirical, which I think he might not have approved of. However, I did wear a Mont Pelerin Society tie, which I think he might have found quite attractive, and that might make up a bit for my being too empirical and econometric in my lecture. This first talk is going to focus on cross-country empirical work, especially on the idea of convergence, the question of whether poor places tend to grow faster than rich ones and thereby tend to catch up to them over time. I'm going to talk particularly about the role of certain policy variables, including whether or not governments maintain property rights and how that enters into the growth process. And I also want to talk about the role of human capital in this process. At the end of the talk today, I wanted to say a little bit about some growth forecasts that come out of this type of modeling, sort of medium-term forecasts over a period roughly from now up to the year 2000. It turns out that if you make that computation for the broad sample of countries for which I have data, the top 7 places in terms of growth forecasts are all in Asia. Although they're not necessarily the traditional East Asian tigers, in fact, 2 of the places which end up being forecasted to have very high growth are India and the Philippines, which have not done particularly well historically, but I'll get back to that a bit later. In the second lecture, which will be tomorrow, I'm going to talk specifically on the interplay between economic and political institutions and the role of democracy as an economic factor, and also what is it that determines how much democracy is in place in a country and how that evolves over time. That will be the focus of my talk tomorrow. The third lecture in this series is going to be on the interplay between inflation and economic growth, the role of monetary policy in the growth process. And this work will be an update, an extension of some work which I began in my stay last year at the Bank of England, where I was a visiting fellow. In the 1960s, growth theory really consisted mainly of the neoclassical growth model. And a primary result in that theory was the convergence hypothesis, the idea that because of diminishing returns, places that started out behind had higher rates of return and some kind of an advantage which made them grow faster. And therefore, there was some kind of automatic tendency for the poor to catch up to the rich. This was a central hypothesis that came out of the neoclassical growth model. Although this theory has been around for a long time, since the 1950s and 60s at least, the convergence hypothesis, I would say, has been stressed as an empirical proposition only relatively recently, and only in the last half a dozen years or so has this hypothesis really been put more strictly to econometric testing, and that there are more results related to tests of this hypothesis, which I would like to discuss. A modification of the theory, which turns out to be quite important, is the concept of conditional convergence. The idea here is that not all countries may be heading in the long run toward the same position. They might not be heading toward the same target level of something like per capita income or product. And that might be because countries have different government policies that they're carrying out. Some, for example, may protect property rights and others may not. Some may distort markets or have high rates of taxation. Countries may also differ in terms of their propensity to save or propensity to have children. And those factors all have influence about where countries are going in the long run. The conditional convergence idea is that you have to hold those kinds of elements constant. And then if you start out below your target, the place where you're tending toward in the long run, then you tend to converge or grow relatively rapidly. But if you have countries that are following poor policies, they tend to have long-run positions that are quite depressed. And then if they start out poor, they don't tend particularly to grow rapidly because they're not below their own target position. So the conditional convergence idea does not necessarily mean that the poor will grow faster than the rich. It's a much more narrow concept, but one which I think has much more explanatory power than the original one. Another feature of the neoclassical growth model is that it implied that in the long run, the growth rate of an economy would tend perhaps to zero because of diminishing returns, or in some other versions, to a growth rate that was determined by some exogenous rate of technological progress, which the theory didn't explain how it came about. The role of the recent endogenous growth theory, developed, I would say, primarily since 1986, 1997, and especially by Paul Romer, is really to supply this missing element in the neoclassical model. So the more recent theories of endogenous growth explain why it is that countries may be able to grow more or less perpetually, and that was particularly by supplying some kind of theory of technological progress. And the theory came from some analysis of what motivated people to do research and development and to discover new ideas which underlay the rate of technological progress, all of which was taken as exogenous in the neoclassical model. So one way to view the recent endogenous growth theory is that it supplies one of the missing elements of the neoclassical model, basically supplies a theory about the long-run rate of growth, And then you can still use the neoclassical model to think about the convergence process between where you are and where you're going in the long run. And the endogenous growth theory tells you more about this long run behavior. Another recent strand of theory combines these two elements. You can think about discovery occurring in leading economies as determining the long run rate of growth basically for the world. And then you can think about the process of diffusion of technology as telling you something about how rapidly the places that start behind catch up to the places that were initially the leaders. That process of catch-up through diffusion of technology, through imitation, is really quite analogous to the process that occurs in the neoclassical growth model. It implies a similar kind of convergence tendency. So the theory about discovery and diffusion of technology kind of combines the two strands of the growth theory. It combines the long-run growth from the endogenous growth theories with the convergence ideas that are in place in the neoclassical older model. In terms of empirical work, the convergence idea is really the main inspiration for the cross-country empirical work that's been carried out. In other words, the main empirical analysis that has been done over the last 5 or 6 years really gets its inspiration more from the older neoclassical model, amended in certain ways to think about government policies, to think about diffusion of technology. But the basic construct is like the convergence behavior that's in the neoclassical model. So I'd say the empirical work really owes a lot more to the older theory than to the newer so-called endogenous growth theory. And I think the empirical work that's been done along the lines of the endogenous models is much more limited up to this stage. So that theory has, as of yet, had much less empirical contribution than the older theory actually has. Now, to summarize the empirical framework that I want to think about, you can really do it in one fairly simple equation. On the left side of the equation is a growth rate, which I'm going to identify with a growth rate of real per capita gross domestic product when I say something empirical. And on the right-hand side, there are really two variables. One that tells you where are you currently, something like the current level of real per capita product. And a second variable which tells you where are you going in the long run. And that, in turn, depends on the kinds of policy variables, perhaps propensity to save and have children, the factors that I've already mentioned. If you hold fixed where you're going in the long run, particularly through these policy variables, then a lower initial position implies through the theory that you should grow faster. That's the conditional convergence property. If you hold fixed where you are currently, then something that raises the long run position will raise the growth rate, at least on impact. So for example, more favorable policies, greater willingness to save, would have that kind of impact positively on the growth rate in the short run until in the long run you're approaching this target position, which is determined in the way I've already suggested. The model doesn't necessarily imply what's called absolute convergence, that is the poor tending in an absolute sense to grow faster than the rich, because these two determinants of growth tend to be highly correlated. In particular, if you observe a country at an arbitrary starting date, which could be 1960, 1970, some arbitrary date, then the level of per capita product that you happen to observe is going to be driven by the policy variables and other characteristics which determine the long-run position. Because after all, the theory says that the country will approach that long-run position over time. So if you observe a poor country, chances are the country is poor because it has crummy policies in place, or that people don't want to save, or they have too many children, all the factors that are adverse. But in other words, there's this correlation, which is highly positive, between the starting position and the target position. Now, what that means is if you don't condition on the elements that determine where you're going in the long run, there's no particular reason to predict that a poor country will grow rapidly. A poor country doesn't tend systematically to be either below or above its target. So on average, it won't grow higher or lower than the typical country. It's only after you condition on these other determinants that the theory, in particular the neoclassical growth model, predicts that you should find the convergence tendency. I think people have handouts, so I won't then try to use the overhead projector. But if you look at figure one, This is now quite a well-known diagram, which demonstrates the lack of absolute convergence in a broad cross-country sample over the period from 1960 to 1990. On the horizontal axis in this diagram, you have an initial position in various particular starting dates I happen to be looking at. It's measured by the logarithm of real per capita gross domestic product. On the vertical axis, you see the growth rate basically on average 10 years after the particular initial positions that happen to be observed. And the obvious finding in this diagram is that there's no relation between these two things. If the poor tended to grow faster than the rich in an absolute sense, then you should find that the countries that started out toward the origin along the horizontal axis should have high values on the vertical axis, that is, high growth rates. And you can see in the diagram you don't find that property at all. If anything, the slope has the wrong sign. It should be negative if convergence held in an absolute sense. It's actually slightly positive, but not significant in a statistical sense. I should also remark here, before I say more about convergence, that even if convergence did hold in an absolute sense, that the poor tended to grow faster than the rich, it would not imply that you should see a declining tendency of inequality over time. That is, you might think that the poor tending to grow faster than the rich ought to mean that the dispersion of per capita income or product ought to decline over time. Now, in fact, that view is a fallacy, which particularly owed to Danny Qua to say that it's Galton's fallacy. That is, he introduced that terminology in the growth literature. Galton studied in particular the distribution of heights and other physical and mental characteristics of a population. And he really had two observations. One is that there tended to be reversion to the mean in terms of where your height was relative to your parents' height. So if your father and mother were taller than average, then the children were taller than average, but not as much as the parents. So there was reversion to the mean across generations. Nevertheless, if you look at the distribution of heights across a population, you found it didn't tend to change particularly over time. It tended to be stable. The reversion to the mean is like the convergence of growth rates. Poor tending to grow faster than the rich, if it's present. The idea that the distribution of heights is relatively stable over time would be the same as saying that the distribution of per capita income across countries or other kinds of economies would not particularly tend to change. It wouldn't tend to become more equal over time. In fact, the distribution of heights or income would depend on really the offset of two forces. One is the convergence tendency, that is, how rapidly things reverted to the mean, and secondly, what kind of disturbances there were and how frequent they were and how large on average. There'd be two offsetting forces there which will determine the distribution of either heights or per capita income, and there's no particular reason why reversion to the mean or convergence will tell you that income is narrowing across the population. So even if I did find convergence in this diagram, the figure one, it wouldn't really predict that inequality would be narrowing. In fact, if you look across roughly 100 countries or a little more, you find that the dispersion of per capita product has actually increased from 1960 to 1990. I think that's a relevant, interesting observation which one ought to worry about, but it doesn't particularly refute the convergence implication of the neoclassical growth model, and it would be incorrect to make that inference. I want to discuss some of my empirical results related to the generalized concept of convergence, the conditional kind of convergence. If you look at table one, which is also in the handout, that has the basic setup for the empirical results that I want to sketch here. So in particular, in column one, what I'm going to be explaining is growth rates of per capita product over various periods. What's on the right-hand side, the explanatory variables, include two types of things. One is the initial position, the logarithm of per capita GDP, and some initial dates, which is the same variable that appeared on the horizontal axis in figure one. Then the other variables which are there, you can think of various observable determinants of where economies are going in the long run. Things related to government policy, things related to fertility behavior, to the willingness to save, and so on, and also elements of human capital, which I'm going to have to discuss. So there are really those two kinds of variables which appear there. In terms of the initial position now, but here I'm holding fixed all these other variables that are in this system, the effect of that is given by the first coefficient, which is in column 1, but you can see this better if you look at figure 2. So you should see quite a dramatic contrast between figure 1, which is the simple relation between growth and initial position, and figure 2, which is the relation between growth and initial position after holding constant the various other determinants that are in table 1, which I'll discuss somewhat more in detail. At least I'll sketch some of those results. So I like to think of this kind of figure as a conditional convergence diagram. It tells you what happens if you change the initial position while holding fixed the various determinants of the long-run target position. Things like government policy, attitudes about saving and fertility, etc. Now, the way this is done here is I used my results in table 1, that is, I used the regression results in that table, to hold fixed the effect of all the other determining variables on growth, and then look just at the partial or conditional relation between growth and the initial position. That's the nature of the construct of this diagram. So it purports to show what would happen if you were poorer, which is moving to the left on the horizontal axis, to the growth rate, but now holding fixed all those other variables, which in the whole sample are very much correlated with the starting position. And that's why the diagram looks quite different. Well, I think you can see in figure 2 that there's quite a pronounced inverse relation between growth and the initial position. So there's quite a bit of evidence that the conditional convergence is there, and that's the property that's predicted by the neoclassical growth model and by some subsequent extensions of that model to which I've already referred. Quantitatively, what this relation means is that an economy would catch up to where it's going at the rate of something like 2.5% per year. That's what the slope means in this diagram. So that's sort of good and bad news, if you like. You can take the good news as being, well, there's some tendency for the poor to catch up, at least if they have the right policies and other variables that determine the long-run position. The bad news is that the rate of convergence is pretty slow. 2.5% per year means it takes a long time to get very far toward where you're getting. So if one's impatient about that process, one's going to be in considerable trouble. I wanted to discuss through these other diagrams some of the other kinds of variables that are being held constant in order to construct this diagram for conditional convergence. So if you turn to figure 3, figure 3 starts to say something about human capital, and particularly something about education. What's being measured here is the years of educational attainment, specifically here for males 25 and over at the upper levels, that is, at secondary and higher schooling that's being measured here, years of schooling for the average person in the population. So this is basically the stock of human capital in this form at the beginning of each of the periods that are being considered. And the positive slope here says that if you hold fixed the starting position, where are you in terms of per capita product, that a higher level of human capital means that you tend to grow faster. Now, there are two ways I think you might think of that. One is that if you have more human capital really in relationship to physical capital, and the other things that determine the level of current output, then it says you tend to grow relatively rapidly. And one reason for that would be that it makes it easier for you to copy the ideas that have been discovered in other countries. In other words, as has been suggested in several theories, the diffusion of technology from a rich to a poor place is eased, if the poor place has enough of a level of human capital so that it can absorb the new ideas rapidly. So that's one thing that would be reflected in this diagram. The other more simple idea says that if you have a lot of human capital and not much physical capital, which is often true in the aftermath of a war, such as at the end of World War II, that it's relatively easy to accumulate the physical capital to match your human capital. And therefore, in that situation, you tend to grow very rapidly for a while until the physical capital has been built up to be commensurate with the high level of human capital. Quantitatively, what this diagram says is if you have one more year of average schooling at the higher levels, however, it means that the growth rate is increased by somewhat more than one percentage point per year, which is a very large effect. So this is a pretty big impact on growth. Now let me say two things in a more negative way about education in terms of what's in these cross-country data. First of all, if you look at male primary education, there's no evidence from the kind of broad cross-country data set that I'm using, which is around 100 countries, 1960 to 1990, that the primary schooling matters for growth. In other words, it seems to be the higher level of schooling that matters. That would fit in with the theories that stress the idea of absorption of technologies from abroad, because presumably at that level, it's secondary and higher education that would matter more than primary schooling. Secondly, and more embarrassingly, if you look at female schooling, I can never find positive effects of that on subsequent growth rates. Now, I should mention that this is a major improvement over some previous results that I had with a colleague that we published about 2 years ago, where we found that female schooling at the start of each of the periods entered negatively in relation to subsequent growth. Since that time, we've done a major revision of the underlying data, not particularly motivated by this finding, but because we think we've improved the data in various respects. As a counterpart of that, we now find that the effect on growth is roughly zero rather than negative, which I think you might agree was a substantial improvement. Now, some people have argued that female schooling should be positive to growth because it does things like reduce fertility rates, reduce infant mortality rates, and indeed, as I'm going to discuss tomorrow, it has a very important positive relationship with political rights in the form of democracy. It turns out that female schooling is about the best predictor you can get about whether a country is going to become more democratic over time. Now, you might have thought that through some of these channels that female schooling ought to have a positive impact on economic growth, and I think that that's actually quite plausible. However, I haven't been able to demonstrate that as a result. Now, some of these other channels are already being held constant in the results that are in the table that I referred to, table one. But I do find that if I omit some of those variables and therefore don't hold them constant, such as the fertility rate, that I still can't demonstrate the positive linkage between female schooling and growth. So there's obviously more work that needs to be done here if one doesn't want to accept this unpleasant conclusion. Now, another result about human capital, going back to the variable that I actually used in figure three, which is the male upper schooling data, is that there's also evidence that if you have more human capital in this form, that the rate of convergence is greater. So I mentioned before there was a tendency to converge at a rate of about 2.5% per year. Well, it turns out if you have an extra year of male schooling, that's my human capital construct here, you actually converge more rapidly, something like 3.2% per year instead of 2.5%. Again, that fits in with the idea that what the human capital is doing is making it easier for you to adapt the technologies invented elsewhere, and that's what would show up in this process of more or less rapid convergence. So I think that fits with some theories that stress that element. Now, if you look at figure six, it tells you particularly about the fertility rate. This is another one of the variables that I was examining in my empirical work in table one. Now, it's often argued that if you have high rates of population growth, that you can't develop and you can't have rapid per capita growth. Now, the finding here is that there is a negative relationship between this rate of fertility, which is the key determinant of population growth, and the rate of growth of the economy in per capita terms. So there is some negative relationship there, even after holding constant a lot of variables that are related to fertility, such as education and per capita income. Those are really being held constant here. So there is some evidence, indeed, that if for some reason societies decide to have fewer children, that they will then tend to grow more rapidly in per capita terms. But one can't say from the evidence that controlling population is the key to economic growth. Certainly there are many countries with low fertility that don't do too well, and there are countries with high fertility that nevertheless grow. So you can't say this is the critical determinant, the key determinant of growth, but it does seem to be a contributor. Figure 7 looks at another variable. I'm going to be looking now at various things that have to do with different dimensions of government policy. Figure 7 looks at the size of government in terms of expenditures, particularly expenditures on consumption elements. And there's some evidence there of a negative relationship. The idea here is I'm trying to capture a form of government expenditure which does not have important consequences directly for productivity. That's the government consumption measure. Here there's some evidence that more of that kind of non-productive activity is associated with lower rates of economic growth. Now, recently, I was asked by the Wall Street Journal to comment about flat tax ideas, which have become particularly prevalent in the current U.S. presidential campaign in the primaries. I guess there's been a lot of rough treatment of this idea by several economists. Particularly Paul Krugman the other day had a nasty column in the New York Times about what a lunatic idea this flat tax was. Naturally, the Wall Street Journal was on the other side of this issue and invited several people, including myself, to comment on the matter, and I think that will be coming out toward the end of this week. I've made some heroic assumptions to try to get an estimate of what the move to a flat rate tax in the United States would do to the growth rate over some horizon of something like 5 years or so. I based the estimate really on the slope that's in Figure 7, which tells me something about what happens when you do more or less government activity and finance it typically with distorting taxation. What does that do to the rate of economic growth? So I actually used this estimate to get some kind of result. And what I found was that if you had a move toward a kind of flat rate tax that, for example, Steve Forbes has been advocating recently in the United States, that the growth rate should go up by something like 0.4% a year. Now, I thought that's actually a very big number, but Forbes has been contending in his campaign that the growth rate would double, which would mean from 2 to 4% in per capita terms in the U.S., roughly speaking. 2% is kind of the long-run rate of per capita growth in the United States, or it has been. So I got some estimate of a fairly important effect from a movement to a flat rate tax from this kind of evidence. But nothing like the evidence, nothing like the estimate that this political candidate offered. Actually, if the growth rate doubled and you projected out what that would mean in terms of higher levels of per capita product down the line, it's really completely unimaginable that you could get that big an effect. Now, if you look at Figure 8, this is another dimension of government policy that I'm trying to measure. Here I've used a subjective index of the extent to which rule of law, maintenance of property rights, security, internal security is maintained in a country. This is prepared by an international consulting company for fee-paying investors who basically want to know whether to put their money in one country or another, and they're particularly concerned if they invest someplace whether the capital will be expropriated by the government or someone else, or whether there's no rule of law that enables them to use contracts and other provisions that are important for their businesses. The evidence is, as shown, for example, in Figure 8, that this is quite important and has a major positive influence on growth. We could quarrel about the nature of the data here, but fortunately, I don't have enough time to do that right now. The last figure in the handout shows you something about terms of trade. It's sometimes been argued that, particularly for poor countries in Africa, that the reason they've done very badly is they've had a lot of adverse movements in the terms of trade related to the primary products that they mainly are exporting. There is evidence in the right direction in the data that an improvement in the terms of trade raises the growth rate, and similarly, a worsening of the trade terms of trade would lower the growth rate. However, it turns out that really this is not the key factor behind the poor growth performance in Africa. And while it does have some influence and is sometimes an important variable, it's not really something that's systematically critical in distinguishing one region of the world from another. So it's a factor that's important to take into account, but it doesn't have the kind of effect that's been suggested in some of the literature. Let me turn back now to Table 1. Now, one property of the data that's been observed quite frequently is that if you look at the period, and here I'm going to be looking from 1975 to 1990, some regions of the world have particularly done badly in terms of economic growth, and some have done systematically well. So in particular, if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, well, first, if you look at the growth rate across all of the countries that I'm considering, which is about 100, that growth rate is 1% per year per capita, from 1975 to 1990. That's the average rate of growth in the whole sample. If you look at the countries of sub-Saharan Africa, the average growth rate over this period is minus 0.1% per year. So it's noticeably below that of the average country in the world. This is also true of Latin American countries. Not quite as bad. The average growth rate over the period is plus 0.1% per year, essentially zero. So that's another poorly performing region of the world in at least this 15-year period. On the other hand, as is well known, if you look at East Asian countries, they've done extremely well. If you look from 1975 to 1990, the average growth rate of the East Asian countries is almost 4% per year. So it's dramatically different from these other two poorly performing regions. So one important question is, does the kind of framework that I have set out and the kind of empirical work that I've done explain this behavior in some sense? In particular, do I have to throw in some funny kind of dummy variable for sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America or East Asia in order to explain why the performance and growth is either poor or good, depending on the case? Or is that mainly already explained by the variables that are in the system? I really look at this as some kind of a crude test of the framework as to whether something important has been omitted, because I don't think you would believe that just because one is in some geographical region that one is going to be growing particularly well or badly. Now, in the first work that I did in this topic, which was in a paper in 1991, which has, I'm afraid, not been cited nearly as often as the paper that Richard mentioned from 1974, which I think he has the citation numbers incorrect, by the way. But we can get back to that if anybody cares. In that first effort I did in this kind of cross-country empirical work, I found that the African countries were systematically doing worse, even after I held constant the variables, and the same was true of Latin America. So something seemed to be important that was left out in explaining that. Now, in column 2 of the first table, I check for that kind of effect again by using these geographical dummies for these three regions that have often been selected out as being special: sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, East Asia. Now, the important finding here is that these variables are no longer important, neither individually nor altogether, which means that the other variables that are in this system are already enough to explain why, at least as a first cut, the African and Latin American countries did poorly, and the East Asian countries did well. So I don't need some other ad hoc geographical dummy to do that. So I think that's quite important, and it's different from the kind of results that were there previously. Now, for the African countries, what turns out to be critical here is especially the rule of law kind of variable, and indeed the fertility rate variable is quite important there. So the inclusion of those variables is important for getting the result that you don't need this geographical measure. For Latin America, the key variable, which I haven't actually discussed yet, is relates to inflation, monetary, perhaps macro policy more broadly, which is going to be the subject of the third lecture that I'll be giving. But it's only when I introduced that kind of variable into the system that it turned out to be true that you didn't any longer need a special geographical variable for Latin America. So that's now being held constant, and that's why I don't get this Latin America influence being separately important. The East Asia variable was actually never important, even in the initial work. That's because some of the other variables that were held constant there, particularly relating to human capital, but also some of the other ones that I've introduced, are important in explaining why those countries did relatively well over the sample period. But it's also true here that those variables are not critical. Finally, I might also mention that one of the early influences that was stressed in the neoclassical model was differences in the propensity to save across countries. It wasn't really explained why countries would be different about their attitudes toward saving, but sometimes cultural influences were invoked in a way that really didn't amount to much of an explanation. I actually find here that if I introduce a variable related to saving, really a ratio of investment to GDP, but that variable is actually not important for growth once I hold fixed the variables that I've already been discussing. That is, the other influences that are there in table one. It turns out that that variable is marginal in terms of whether or not it has a positive influence on growth, although it has been stressed in the literature as being one of the key robust determinants, which I think is actually not correct. I think one reason for that is that there probably isn't much in the way of exogenous differences across countries in the willingness to save once you've held fixed the kinds of variables that I've already discussed. Secondly, in terms of open economies, there's no particular reason that you'd grow fast if you're very willing to save. Instead, you'd expect the saving to flow to places that have high productivity of investment, and that's where the growth will occur. But you wouldn't expect that to occur just because you had a higher propensity to save. Let me quickly say something about table two. The results I've been focusing on come from a panel estimation. What that does is combine two kinds of information. It has information about a cross-sectional experience of countries, and it also has information about the behavior over time within countries. So it has two dimensions of the data in it. Some economists don't seem to like to use the cross-sectional information. And the reason for that can be clarified by going back to figures 1 and 2. If you look at figures 1 and 2, the problem with figure 1 is it didn't hold constant any of these determinants of the long-run position. And you can see that if you do that, you don't get a very good estimate of how fast countries converge. You get some ridiculous estimate. It's important to hold constant these other determinants. That's what's done in figure 2. But suppose I haven't done this perfectly. Suppose I haven't held constant all the policy and other influences that matter for the long-run position. Suppose I've omitted some of that. Then I can still have some of the problem that characterizes the difference between figures 1 and 2. If I have some omitted features of countries that matter for the long-run position, I might still be underestimating the rate of convergence. That's what happens from going from figure 1 to figure 2, but I still might have that problem. And then a common way of treating that people have used is to use just the time series information within countries to argue that there's some other influences about where you're going in the long run about countries, so-called fixed effects about countries, which you have to worry about. And the way that's often treated is basically just to look at changes over time within countries, so-called first differences. If you look at table two, it shows you how to break up the results that I focused on, which are the so-called panel results, into these two alternative sources of information. The first difference results is just telling you what happens over time. The cross-section results is just telling you what happens across countries. The panel combines the two. I found there are two different kinds of reactions to these different ways of looking at the data. My own background, and I think it's typical of macroeconomists, is that you start out worrying about time series, and you think there are a lot of problems about what happens over time and sorting things out. And if you start from that background, you really love it if you have a cross-section. You think then cross-sections are wonderful, that there's a tremendous variation in the data and much more information than you could ever imagine from time series. So I think typically, though not always, macroeconomists put more weight on the cross-sectional evidence, or at least I look at it that way. If you talk about microeconomic people who tend to have tremendous numbers of observations on individuals, they take this different perspective. And they worry about the problem I said before about these fixed effects. And they tend, therefore, to concentrate on the changes over time, which is this first difference column, and basically get rid of the cross-sectional information. In the perspective of growth, I find when you do that, that you throw out most of the information that's in the sample, and therefore I find that it's a big problem. Now, you can at your leisure look at table 2 and see how the different results occur depending on which features of the data that you focus on. Now, in fact, the optimal state would be if both dimensions of the data gave the same kind of information, and unfortunately, that's not quite true if you look at the results. I focused on the panel results, which combine the two sources of imperfect information, rather than one or the other, because I don't see a reason why one would prefer one to the other, although there are differences here and some controversies about that. I wanted to finish up by talking about these growth forecasts, which I referred to at the beginning of the talk. So let me tell you in a very quick way what the estimation I've done suggests if you use it to forecast growth of different parts of the world, roughly over the period from today up to the year 2000, so roughly over a 5-year horizon. Let me put this first in terms of some major regions of the world as to what would be predicted. If you look at sub-Saharan Africa, the predicted growth rate over that period is zero, which is actually close to what it was historically. So the kind of framework I have does not suggest that the African region is going to do better than it has over the next 5 years or so. If you look at Latin America, the predicted growth rate is about 1% per year, slightly better than the history, but not very robust. It actually turns out for Latin America that it's quite critical whether or not inflation is brought under control. If you assume that inflation is brought under control in Latin America, the predicted growth rate is 2.5% instead of 1%, so it actually makes a big difference there. If you look at the East Asian countries, which did well historically, the model predicts that they're also going to do well in the next 5 years or so, growth of roughly 3.5% per year, only slightly below the historical period that I referred to. If you look in Western Europe, the predicted growth rate is about 2%. Slightly below the historical experience. This is per capita growth in each case. I might mention that for the United States, the prediction from the model is growth of about 1.5%, slightly lower than Western Europe as a whole. I'll just quickly tell you what the model says are the most favorable places in terms of growth, but you should take into account that many countries are not in this sample because of missing data. So it might be, particularly in terms of countries in Central Europe, they're mainly not in the sample because the data are not available. If you look at the top 15 countries in terms of forecasted growth over the next 5 years, 11 of them are in Asia. Not necessarily, however, in East Asia. Actually, the country that's forecasted to have the highest growth rate is Jordan, about 6% a year. That's partly because it did so badly recently, and the model forecasts a strong convergence tendency in that case because it's starting from lower per capita output than it should have had. Second place goes to Korea, which is also the co-champion for growth over the previous 30 years, co-champion along with Singapore. Third place is actually for India, which has done extremely poorly in the history, or actually it grew at 1.5% per year from 1960 to 92. The model says there's a lot of potential there. And just quickly, the other countries that are in the list going down from the top are Sri Lanka, which is another place that is apparently underperformed, Malaysia, Singapore, and the Philippines. The Philippines and Sri Lanka are the two East Asian cases that are often notable for having done much worse than you would have predicted. The only country in Western Europe that's forecasted by this model to have relatively high growth is actually Greece. Again, there's a convergence tendency in this kind of model, so if you start out behind and other things are reasonably well in place, the forecast is that you should do relatively well. The Netherlands actually is the next highest in Western Europe in terms of the forecast from this model. In terms of poor growing countries, a lot of those are in Africa. Half of the 15 poorest predicted growth countries are in sub-Saharan Africa, which is fits in with the historical experience. Another country that's predicted to do very badly is Brazil. But as I mentioned, there's a big question about Latin America. For example, if you just use the historical experience for Argentina and Peru, and you don't particularly take account of the fact that it looks like those countries have a very good stabilization program in place, then you predict that growth for those countries is something like 0 to 1%. But if you believe that those countries have successfully stabilized, and in particular have controlled inflation in the long run, then the prediction is that you would get growth between 3 and 4% per capita in Argentina and Peru, which would be quite favorable outcomes. The only country in Latin America that seems really solid as a prediction of substantial growth is Chile, which is predicted to have growth of almost 3% per year, which is quite strong. I don't know if you want to take these growth forecasts seriously. Naturally, I've invested all my money in the countries that I predicted to grow at rapid rates, but you may not want to rely on my model to the extent that I do.
Well, thank you for that really wonderful lecture. I think that that's a real tour de force, such a complex subject explained in a way that I hope everybody here could follow. It's a real model of how to do research and how to present it. And we're really grateful, Bob. Now, I'm sure it's raised one or two questions in your mind. I won't ask him about Russia, where I put my money, because he said the data can't be relied on. But I'm sure all of you have got things on your mind. I think people should feel free to ask big questions, not just technical questions on the exact analysis, but we don't often have someone like this here, and feel free to ask any question within the broad ambit, I would say, of the issues that have been raised. So who'd like to go first? Don't be shy.
In a general sense, I'm sympathetic to the idea that cultural elements might be important for growth and other things, and that religion would be a significant part of that. And of course, religion used to be an important element of what economists studied, but it's gone very much out of fashion. I've actually been trying to quantify that in my current research, looking particularly at religion, partly because I don't know how to quantify cultural elements in some other manner. Now, in terms of the work I'm going to discuss tomorrow, religion has been particularly raised as an element in the determinants of democracy, because it's observed that, for example, basically all Protestant countries are highly democratic, and pretty much no Muslim countries are democratic. And if you look at data as to some reasonable measures of democracy, that seems to be true. On the other hand, I also find that once you hold fixed various kinds of economic variables, per capita income, measures of education, and other things, that influence goes away. That even though there's a dramatic break between democracy, for example, in these two groups that I refer to, once you hold constant other things, and as I mentioned before, female schooling is one of the principal elements there, then the religion variables that I've looked at no longer matter. This is for democracy. The variables I've been looking at are just measures of nominal affiliation. So I know things about the breakdown of the population of countries into the various major religions. What I'd really like to know is things like how serious are people about this, and what do different religions say about whether or not it's a good idea to have material improvements, how much expenditure and church attendance is there, and that kind of thing. But those data I don't have at the moment. So the only thing I've looked at is this affiliation influence. Now, at this stage, I don't find that to be important, either for the political element, where it's been particularly raised, or indeed for the growth analysis that I've gone through. But I sort of haven't given up on that. I think that potentially might be quite important. But you know, some people just tend to say, well, cultural elements are important, and basically leave it at that. And then if you can't quantify that in some manner, I think it's a bit empty. So it may turn out to be something more than that down the road.
Could you say something about the importance or otherwise of raw material endowments? I think there has been a good deal of research on this, suggesting perhaps that the effect of being well endowed with raw materials is negative, and having no raw materials, as in the case of Japan, is rather positive. So have you tried fitting that into your system and rejecting it, or what?
There's three kinds of measures that have been looked at that I think are related here. They're all sort of money for nothing kind of variables. One is raw materials. If you start out with a lot of natural resources, oil and some others, that's sort of an example of how you might have a lot of wealth without having done anything to accumulate it. Another is foreign aid, which is another way you can get money without sort of doing anything productive. And a third one is defaulting on debt. It's another way to get it. I'm talking here about sovereign debt, so that the central government would default. I've talked with my colleague Jeff Sachs a lot about this idea, and he's very sympathetic to the idea that the first two elements are negative for growth. Natural resources and foreign aid, he somehow thinks, are both negatives for growth. And he indeed has done some recent research with a colleague on the natural resource question, and Peter Boone has done a lot of work here on foreign aid. But Jeff rejects the idea that default on debt is harmful, and I never understood the asymmetry here. It seems as if Jeff thinks that if you default on debt, that he gets to control the benefit of that and the proceeds, because he's going to tell the government what to do in terms of policy, and if they do the right thing, it'll be a big benefit. But as I suggested, to me, these are all three things of the same kind. And I haven't looked at these all in detail, but I believe it's true that there is some negative element of both of them. As I say, Sachs with Andrew Warner has documented this to some degree with respect to natural resources, along the lines that you suggested. Peter Boone has gotten something similar with foreign aid and work here. Default on debt, I don't know of in terms of systematic research along these lines. My conjecture would be that it would end up similar. Now, the usual argument for why this is negative is a political one, that in particular, if something happens to create all these resources that nothing was built up to justify, that then there tends to be a political fight about how they're going to be used, and it tends to be channeled in unproductive ways, including the non-productive government expenditures. And some of that has been documented with respect to the foreign aid. But I think the main argument about why it is that you might be given something and then do worse because of it is a political theory about what happens when there's this pot of stuff available that can be fought over in the political arena. That's the theory. I don't know that that's been directly proven. Well, I'm involved with an ongoing project trying to improve the quality of the cross-country education data. I referred to that in passing earlier, which had to do with getting improved measures just of the years of schooling, which is not the quality measure that you wanted, but part of that project was just getting better measures of years of education at various levels. Now, I've also been constructing a number of proxies for the quality of schooling. The main problem here is to get measures that you can get for a large number of countries in a reasonably consistent manner, which proves to be difficult. We have assembled a number of proxies like that, and we're just getting to the stage of really analyzing them. I mean, the kinds of things that are available are things like teacher-pupil ratios, various measures of expenditure on education, estimates of salaries of teachers. I'm talking about things that you can get for large numbers of countries. You can get data on dropout and repeat rates. Those are sort of an outcome variable, but you can measure those things. And the other thing you can get is some internationally comparable test scores, in particularly math and science, but also in reading comprehension. Now, those variables have a lot of explanatory power for growth and other things. It's just not quite clear what they're picking up, whether it's really picking up educational inputs or it's something about the native population being superior that it's getting. Because, in fact, when people try to relate objective inputs to things like test outcomes, you don't do very well. There does seem to be a lot of explanatory power in these test scores, which are now available for 50-some countries, so there's a bigger sample than there used to be on that. With respect to primary schooling, let me just say what I find empirically. If you look at things like fertility rates, infant mortality rates, you find that primary schooling is central there, particularly female primary schooling. And I think this is well known in the development literature, and I believe that's correct. That particularly when women have higher schooling at the primary level, they tend to have fewer children, and the children tend to survive better. That is, the infant mortality rate is lower. And it looks like that the channel is somehow going through that. Presumably, that's because the women are mainly serving as mothers raising the children. And that level of schooling is probably what's... And in particular, I don't find that the female schooling is predictive. I would be perfectly happy to find that. I would be perfectly happy to find that the primary schooling were important. It doesn't seem to be in the data. I say the role of the higher level schooling fits in with models that stress the idea of absorbing the new ideas and technologies that have been discovered, where it's probably the more advanced kind of education, human capital, that matters there. You know, I have a less good story about the male versus female, but in fact, in a lot of regions of the world, it's primarily the males who are the main economic actors in terms of actually working in the market. That's probably why it's mainly picking that up.
Yes. If an incoming American president asks your advice on the key issues for sustainable economic growth between now and the end of the century, what's your advice on these key issues? By sustainable, I mean balance between trade and people. If you're asked a similar advice, but this time in John Chancellor and the Japanese Prime
I'm sure no sensible political office holder would ask my advice on these matters. And if so, they no doubt wouldn't have deserved to be elected. But the kinds of things that end up being important, which I don't think really differ if you ask me about the United States, the United Kingdom, or Japan, are not really very surprising things. I think it's things that maintain a lot of economic freedom, rule of law, property rights. I think that's important. That's particularly important if you go away from the main developed countries and look at poorer places where often these rights are not respected at all. Free markets, I think, are central, and I think some of the measures I have relate to distortions of markets and demonstrate some adverse consequences of those. Human capital accumulation is important, particularly of a certain type. How much role there is for government policy there is less clear-cut. Obviously, people have lots of individual incentive to accumulate this human capital, so I don't think I could go from the evidence I have to a policy statement that would say we should put a lot more money into education or higher level education or whatever. With respect to inflation, deflation, I think there's no evidence, particularly if you look at growth in the kind of horizon I'm looking at, which is 5 years or more, that you buy anything at all by having more inflation. I mean, there's no evidence of a trade-off here, where over some range, if you accept inflation, you get higher growth. There's no evidence for that. At the same time, the evidence that inflation is adverse for growth comes from the experience of the more rapid, extreme inflations, not from the kind of relatively moderate inflations that characterize the main developed countries. I would say that price stability is the correct goal, and that that fits in very well with the objective of sustaining a good rate of economic growth. I haven't, in my empirical work, measured something directly which would look like that kind of investment subsidy. I think Singapore is probably the country that's pursued that the most over this sample period, particularly with respect to encouraging foreign investment and to constraining the domestic residents to have high saving rates. Although I find if you talk to officials in Singapore, they deny that they've ever subsidized anybody's investment. Now, I say I don't have a measure of that directly. In my analysis, if investment is just exogenously higher, it doesn't particularly help for growth. In other words, if the other fundamental conditions are not in place, in terms of market structure, property rights, and so on, then an exogenous increase in the investment rate doesn't look particularly favorable to growth. That's probably what would be reflected in the policy variables that you suggest. But the caution is that I haven't looked at that in a more direct sense.
Okay, we'll have one more.
Do you think that the relationship between human capital and growth is really something like cause and effect, or could it just be a mere correlation so that human capital accumulation is something like inherent to economic growth, so you just couldn't say
there's clearly an important two-way interplay there. And, you know, some other research suggested, indeed, that there's some tendency for economies when they develop to have a feedback on human capital to develop. The evidence of the causation, you know, as in most circumstances, really comes from the timing evidence, that what's true in the data is I'm looking at earlier values of human capital, particularly in terms of the education stock or health variables that I'm looking at, and relating that to subsequent rates of economic growth. And that timing evidence is at least suggestive that the causation is in that direction. In addition to that, there'd be this other mechanism where as you became more prosperous, you would tend to accumulate perhaps more human capital, and certainly to have improvements in life expectancy, infant mortality, and so on. So there would be this two-way interplay. The nature of the two-way process is being identified to the extent that it can be done satisfactorily through really this timing evidence.
I think we should let you off the hook. Especially since this is the first of three laps. I think you've done a wonderful job. It's been a great experience for us all. The next lap is tomorrow at the same time. And the topic is the interplay between economic and political development. And thank you for the wonderful start.